Welcome to the Cloud Pod, where the forecast is always cloudy. We talk weekly about all things AWS, GCP, and Azure. We are your hosts,
Justin,
Jonathan,
Ryan,
and Peter.
Episode 150, recorded on January 26th, 2022. Ooh, look, I've messed it up already. The Cloud Pod exfiltrates Jonathan's credentials. Man, this 22 thing, I cannot get this behind me. I don't know about you guys, but I just can't do it.
Too many twos.
It's going to be a tough one.
Too many twos. It's going to be a tough year. Like, I'm just going to leave that in the show for people to enjoy. Yeah. Who doesn't love a good blurper?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, it's the third show of 2022, and we're still not with full hosts. So I apologize for that. Jonathan is still missing. He'll hopefully join us back next week. But we got Peter, we've got Ryan, so we're in good shape. We can get to the news this week, which was plentiful, but not too plentiful, which is always the nice thing. So first, Amazon GuardDuty has enhanced the detection of EC2 instance credit exfiltration. Of course, if you know what Amazon GuardDuty is, which is a threat detection service that monitors your accounts for malicious activity and gives you very annoying warnings all the time, unless you're in security, then you care. They are adding the ability to detect when your EC2 instance credentials are being used from another AWS account. And for those of you at home saying, well, they already had that. Well, they did, but only if you were outside of Amazon. So the smart hackers that they are decided, well, if I just run my hack from inside AWS accounts, it won't trigger your GuardDuty, and you'll never know I'm in using your credentials that I stole from your poorly secured web application and your EC2 instance metadata, which is a problem. So now that's no longer the case. If you are in a different account than the account that has it and you're not using a cross-account role properly, this will now flag you in GuardDuty, so you can now investigate and find out that your credentials were stolen and used by a hacker in another account, which is always good. Interestingly enough, this article, when I first posted it in here, was using IMDS v1 and was magically updated to IMDS v2 shortly after the superglue issue and breaking formation, which is a nice, I see it's already having impact, yep. Which I super appreciate.
Yeah, this is sort of a surprising one because I knew about the limitation where it was only exposed, you know, eventing on outside credential use, but it's sort of surprising considering how easy it is to detect that it's not being run from an EC2 instance itself. And that was a little strange that they didn't include that. You know, I'm happy to see these improvements now. You know, I'm all for MVP development patterns, so I get it. So that's cool. It's an advantage.
Yeah. I do feel like this is the biggest risk to cloud infrastructure is it's your one secret key access key away from big boo-boo. Mm-hmm. And so anything we could do.
Well, I mean, it's also the powerful part of cloud too, right? Because it gets rid of so many patterns and, you know, putting credentials in files. But it also has this risk that if you own the box, you own that credential too. And if you use that credential in too many places, now you've exposed yourself across the board.
Yeah, so all of the warnings are good.
Yes.
I'd rather get false positives here than miss one.
Great. Well, speaking of warnings, if you've been doing Amazon for a while, you know that there's multiple places that will tell you about security issues, including the Amazon Security Hub, which is where you would like all of your security issues to be reported. But unfortunately, that did not include AWS Health or AWS Trusted Advisor security health issues. And so that has now been fixed with the release this week of a new Security Hub feature that allows you to automatically pull in the items from both AWS Health and AWS Trusted Advisor, giving you that one-stop shop for all your security issues and for your security SOC team to live and breathe every day and give you remediation tickets for.
So I look forward.
Better than just saying no.
I look forward for the next round of, you know, telling the SOC team that no, the root accounts aren't just exposed without MFA. They don't have password accounts assigned. Thanks, Trusted Advisor.
Yeah, that is still annoying.
It is still really annoying. But,
so that you got through all the exceptions and all the stuff you were, you know, doing with your cloud security posture management tool to now get added into GuardDuty. So now they get to get reflagged all again. Mm-hmm. That's great. Yeah, I didn't think about that.
That's exactly what's going to happen awesome. Too.
Yeah, for sure. Well. Well, for those of you who are using ECS Anywhere and potentially were super excited about that ECS exec thing we talked about several times already, I think it was multiple people's favorite pick of announcement of 2021, as well as we talked about when I announced, you were sort of disappointed because if you're using on-prem, you couldn't do that. But I'm now pleased to announce that you can use it on-premise Of course, it requires you to be using Amazon Linux 2, which you can also now run on-premise. So if you've been wanting that ECS exec stuff on-premise, you can now use that with Amazon Linux 2 and the ECS exec capabilities they released last year. And break glass in AWS is super easy with this new method, which is something you definitely need in an SRE incident and pretty awesome.
Yeah, it really helps with what I want to continue working with, which is the migration path of transform, then migrate, instead of migrate, like lift and shift and then transform. So if you're going to ECS, that's how great you can get it all running in your data center before you even, and on the operating system you want to be on before you even move it.
Yeah. The only confusing part to me is the integration at the OS level that this seems to require and how they sort of enabled it, right? You know, with the optimized images in Amazon Works, you know, environments, it makes sense to me that they're just adding optimizations and, you know, tunings to the OS level that I would need to do, and they're doing it for me. This smells of something different since it's not the ECS optimized, you know, AMI. This is just the Amazon Linux OS. So what are they baking into that OS that allows this?
The SSM agent, of course.
I wish that the blog article had a lot more details about that. It's definitely curious.
Yeah, I mean, I assume it has to do with SSM and how SSM works with AL2 and probably the way they implemented the feature. Because, you know, if you think about the security risks of being able to do ECS exec without having an instance metadata service, I can see that being difficult. And so I imagine there's some probably connectivity to AL2 back to the mothership to get credentials that it could use for this functionality that you can't get in Red Hat or Ubuntu or something else.
Seems like just the type of implementation detail, though, that you would want to be aware of when rolling this out, like enabling this.
You would think so, right? But you know what I'm most excited about this announcement is that I no longer have to now contemplate deploying Fedora to get a Yum-based, a Red Hat-based enterprise product without having to pay for it anymore. Because with CentOS dying a horrible death, that was really your only option was to run Fedora. But now I have Amazon Linux too, so I can use that until they port to Fedora too, which will also happen. But, yeah, for now, I'm in good shape for at least another 6 months. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I've taken to looking at other options besides Yum for the same, you know, that's definitely swayed my choices for OS for a long time. But with all the latest announcements, and I don't see how I could continue to carry that forward. Sucks.
Yeah, I've been an Ubuntu user at home for so long, but I've always just been Red Hat or CentOS at work because that's what, you know, enterprise software requires typically, because that's the one enterprise one that's out there. But that's starting to change now, and it'll be interesting to see if Ubuntu starts getting a bigger traction in enterprise or not. Mm-hmm.
It's great. IBM bought it just in time for it to be demonetized.
Just in time to make everyone mad.
Just in time for people to not pay for it anymore.
Well, I mean, it's changes directly in result of the IBM purchase, I think. At least it seems seemingly that way with the CentOS changes. So yeah, it does make sense.
But, you know, it's like, while there's a ton of customers who are potentially making that pivot from Red Hat Enterprise Linux to CentOS, I feel like the number was probably more the other way, from CentOS to Red Hat Enterprise Linux for companies who wanted support. So, now I don't know that it's as simple to just switch between the two, which is also now I have to re-implement my application to get off of Fedora to use Red Hat Enterprise Linux. That's now friction I have to now deal with in the process. It seems a little short-sighted in some ways. All right. And then our last AWS announcement for this week is EFS. So EFS is a great solution for shared storage for things like containers or your Lambda functions, but it had some issues, mostly performance. But if you wanted to replicate data for business continuity or compliance needs for DR, there wasn't really a lot of great ways to do that beyond AWS backup. And so now you can enable replication for EFS to automatically maintain copies of your EFS file system. The replication supports replication within a single AWS region or between two AWS regions in the same AWS partition. Once configured, the replication begins immediately and traverses the AWS global backbone, and most changes are replicated within a minute with an RPO of 15 minutes for most file systems, which is pretty great. Replication will not consume your burst credits nor count against provision throughput of the file system, which, wow, that's really nice, AWS, because I assumed you would charge me for both of those things. I really do appreciate that. There are a couple things to know. This is limited by the fact that it's not block-based, or it is block-based, so it's not crash-consistent. And if you need that, AWS still recommends you use AWS Backup. And, of course, since you're transferring between regions or availability zones, you do pay those pesky inter-region transfer fees, which could cost you quite a bit. So do keep that in mind before just enabling this on all of your EFS volumes very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's always the caveat with these things. It's like, this doesn't really replace backup. It changes sort of maybe the frequency in which you use the backup service to create those, you know, those snapshots. So you can always do a point in time restore. But it does enable some huge advances in, you know, eventual consistency for applications that are span multiple regions. And very cool.
Yeah, now I'm just waiting for, you know, bidirectional, write anywhere, and a one-to-many replication, and then I'll be really set with this product.
And by then, I assume I'll have a unicorn that I ride around, and I won't care about any of these things anymore.
Hey, that's what I said about ESS Exec, too. So, you know, I have that now.
it's easy.
I can no longer say these things that, like, oh, that'll never happen, because things that I thought were never going to happen have happened now, and I it's broken my entire worldview.
Hey, if you can get around the speed of light, no problem. Do it.
That one we have not figured out yet, but
maybe quantum entanglement. Yes, we have.
Okay. We have not figured that out at any scale that we could use. All right. Well, let's move to Mountain View with GCP. They have announced the Google Cloud Deploy is now generally available. Google Cloud Deploy, or I'm going to call it for now GCD, is a managed opinionated continuous delivery service that makes continuous delivery to GKE easier, faster, and more reliable. Before they started building this, they surveyed their customers and asked them what they wanted, which is very novel and kind to do. And three themes emerged from that, being like GKE cost of ownership, the security audit, and how do you measure your GKE or infrastructure. And so the findings of that was that the operational cost of Kubernetes continuous deployment can be very high, identifying best and repeatable practices, scaling delivery tools and pipelines, collecting key metrics, and staying current is resource intensive and takes time away from your core business. So Google Cloud Deploy, or GCD, likes to eliminate the scaling and maintenance responsibility that typically comes with self-managed CD solutions. Now you can reclaim that time spent working on your CD tooling. The other advantage is that Google Cloud Deploy gives you opinionated structure, delivery pipelines, and targets are defined declaratively and retained with each release, meaning if your pipeline changes, the release path to production remains durable. No more time lost troubleshooting issues on in-flight releases caused by changes made to the delivery pipeline, which that alone makes me want to use this
tool. Right? Yeah. That's amazing.
That is amazing. GCD focuses the needs on the personas optimized for the reviews, decisions, and to improve the efficiency of each persona type. Lots of users, of course, interact with your software delivery teams, but you need fine-grained access control to allow decisions to be made by the persona that controls the authority, and GCD enables fine-grained restrictions via IAM with discrete access controls and execution-level security. GCD also supports deployments to private GKE clusters and VPC service controls to respect security perimeters and includes taking advantage of flow management for controlling promotion, rollback, and approvals. Of course, auditing is handled by cloud audit logging, which is, of course, what you do for everything. And finally, measuring the pipeline is important, particularly deployment frequency. And so GCD has several built-in metrics to get you an instant view of your entire delivery pipeline, which is pretty nice. Google says they're just getting started, and they have lots more to share and release later on in the year. And I guess this means their answer to Argo at the end of the day.
I mean, I think I poo-pooed this when they announced the pre-release of it, because I was like, oh, it's a CI/CD pipeline. Yay. But, you know, reading through the features that they've included with NGA, like, I've built a lot of this out for several different companies at this point. And yeah, this is a really expensive and hard to implement solution that they're replacing with a service.
So you're saying you're really expensive, Ryan?
Saying I'm really expensive. Yeah. I'm hoping GCD isn't that expensive because it's a managed service and you can leverage the economy at scale. But this is fantastic, you know, and it's got the extra bells and whistles that I would like from managed service. The visibility and the metrics is key, and it's usually something that's, you know, not included. That's great.
Yeah, we've been doing a bunch of Argo implementations, so it'll be interesting to see if this is like significantly lower level of effort to get implemented.
So looking at the pricing here, because you mentioned pricing, and is it cheaper than Ryan or not cheaper than Ryan? And I'm going to guess it's cheaper than Ryan, because Google Cloud Deploy customers are charged a management fee per active pipeline each month. There is no charge for the first active delivery pipeline per billing account for each month, with each additional delivery pipeline costing only $15 per month.
Sounds cheaper than me. I'm expensive.
Yeah, but there's still work you got to do to maintain the GCD pipelines you create. It's not like they're just, it's not like you just say, computer, set up CICD pipeline for my app.
But they're giving you an opinionated one already. So chances are most use cases you'll be able to use their opinionated pipeline and you don't have to make that many changes to it. And if you do make changes to it, you're not breaking the rest of the thing because that's durable, which is even better. So,
computer,
deploy my container.
Yeah.
Many devs would love that feature.
That's all we need to do is build a voice bot that has API access and we could totally make this happen. This would be fantastic.
You totally could. It'd be great. All right. Well, that was it for Mountain View. They didn't have a lot, but what they had was mighty, and I appreciate that. So we go to Redmond with Azure. And first up is you can now leverage Elasticsearch integrations for your observability of Spring Boot apps on Azure. This makes it seamless to ship your Microsoft Azure Spring Cloud logs and metrics directly into Elastic, instrument your Spring Boot applications, and monitor every step of your cloud journey. You get a holistic view across Spring Boot applications and other logs metrics in your cloud and on-premise environment. And by leveraging the APM and logging from Elastic, you can get a unified observability dashboard to see how your applications are performing on Azure. With a full suite of capabilities, of course, you also get logging, metrics, APM, and ML, because everything needs to have ML, to extract your new insights from your Spring Cloud data. And your security team, you can also enable Elastic Security Module to start threat hunting and identifying SIEM and endpoint needs. While this is great, a truly a managed service from Azure for Elasticsearch would be even better, but unfortunately, they only offer you the Elastic Cloud sold through Azure to get all this capability and then integrate it into your Spring Cloud Boot. So this apparently is a renewal of the partnership and a press release related to that partnership, because that's what this reads like.
I hate this announcement because it's not, there's nothing in the announcement. Like that's a thing. Like this is instructions on how to instrument your Spring Boot app. There's nothing specific about this being Azure. This is just any APM instrumentation you need to do. And it's not really any kind of native enhancement over shipping stuff to Elasticsearch. Like there's no native integration with the logging service. I really don't understand what this is. Like I've read it twice now and I'm looking at it going, these are features of Elasticsearch. Cool. And it happens to be in Azure. Cool.
Well, so there is a new Azure console here, the diagnostic setting page of the Azure Spring Cloud. And it has a checkbox that says send to partner solution. And then you choose your subscription and your Elastic cluster. So, I mean, that's now built in. I mean, that's a thing. It didn't exist before.
Okay.
And then, you know, everything else, though, is you're right. You're just instrumenting your own code like you would any Elasticsearch implementation you want to do. So that, but that one checkbox is worth a 3,000-word blog post because they just renewed their partnership. Clearly, that's what I'm telling you.
Well, I find it funny because you typically, when you're instrumenting your code, like you have to instrument it with at least some ability to point to the Elasticsearch service that you want to, you know, visualize your metrics. And so, while the checkbox,
that's just for the logs, to be fair. That's just the logs. To instrument your Spring Boot app, you have to then do more magic though yourself. And, you know, like you have to give it JVM options and you have to tell it the environment for the Elastic APM and give it your secret keys and URLs, which if it was just built in, it would just do that automatically for you, but it's not. So,
I mean, the poor teams who click this checkbox and then think that their logs are going to just be magically parsable and easy to search in Elasticsearch. Like, oh my God, that's not how this works.
I mean, maybe there's some opinionation about Azure Spring Boot that they require you to do standard logging formats that makes it easy, but I doubt
it's not in the article. That's what I was hoping for.
I know,
like something, give me some meat where I can be like, oh, cool. This is how they think you should format your data. This is, you know, this is what schema they want to use. No.
Well, I do have to say that that was the best story we had for Azure for the week, so it can only go downhill from there. So I apologize for that in advance. Although we do have an interesting one, but let's get through the two boring ones. So first up is Azure Kubernetes enhancements. So the first one is Azure Kubernetes support for upgrade events. So now you can actually upgrade your Azure Kubernetes cluster without having to redeploy the whole thing, which, you know, is nice. I appreciate that. All built into the lifecycle capabilities of the thing. And then if you've been using Containerd for your Linux workloads on AKS and you were sad that your Windows workloads were still using Docker, that's now been resolved, and you can now use Containerd with Kubernetes 1.2, which will become the default for all deployments starting with Kubernetes 1.2.3 for both Windows and Linux. So now you can get off of your Docker licensing and get onto Containerd and pay nothing for your containers, which is much better. And then the most exciting part of all is that AKS now has Ultra Disk support. So you can now burn piles of money from multiple directions with both Kubernetes and Ultra Disk and Windows VMs.
Excellent.
Which is the only way to burn money.
Yeah.
So that, yeah, that's exciting. I'm super glad for people using Azure Kubernetes Service. The four of you out there, I'm sure, are super happy with this.
Yeah, but think if you're that poor person who went to go upgrade their Kubernetes cluster and realized that there wasn't an option. So,
well, I mean, like most of the cloud providers, until the last 6 months, of you had to redeploy the whole cluster. Yeah. So it's not like it's that unique to them.
Hey, everyone. Jonathan here. I just wanted to take a minute to thank the cloud consulting gurus at Foghorn for helping make the Cloud Pod possible. These folks truly get it. Cloud consulting experts since 2008. They are premier tier partners with AWS, Google Cloud Platform Silver, and Microsoft Azure partners. From multi-cloud to containers to moving full production workloads to the cloud under the tightest compliance, Foghorn's team of full-stack cloud engineers have been there, done that, gotten the t-shirt, and are ready to share their experience with you. If you're in the market for some talent to supplement your team, visit www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. www.fogops.io/thecloudpod. Foghorn, the promise of cloud delivered.
All right. Well, then, if you're using the Azure NetApp Files features, they have some exciting stuff for you this week. Let me tell you. First up, if you were annoyed that you could deploy volumes that had NFS or volumes that had SMB support, but you couldn't have them do both, that has now been resolved. You can now have volumes that support both NFS and SMB. So your Linux and Windows boxes can now talk to the same file store and save you hopefully some money, because otherwise that's just annoying. And then if you were upset that you cannot connect to your ADDS LDAP server or Active Directory LDAP via TLS, you can now do that. So someone in security is cheering. As well as SMB3 protocol encryption has now been enabled. Again, security cheering. And which is all great. It is also available in more regions, and they have enabled more cross-region replication pairs as well, making all of your DR dreams real with NetApp file features, which, you know, I like NetApp. I like their cloud volume stuff, but, you know, Azure's implementation is lacking just a little bit.
Which is interesting, because the way they rolled it out, their partnership with NetApp was a little different than some of the other cloud providers. And so it's like that was much more a partnership and not just NetApp deploying stuff near the data center and sort of rolling the service in. So that's, it is interesting that the, some of these features are lacking with that relationship.
Yeah, it is a little weird.
I know that the NetApp has always been a software company, but it's still challenging for me to think about paying NetApp for not getting any hardware from them.
Well, if you would like to use SIFS or NFS on like the Google Cloud, you have to use cloud volumes from NetApp. Because GCP doesn't have that for you, so you have to get it from NetApp. So I hear you, and I do feel weird about that, but the reality is that some of those cloud providers just don't have this capability without NetApp. So I appreciate that this is available on many of these. All right, well, if I made your security people happy with all that cheering about encryption, I now make you sad, because the next up is the Azure DDoS update for the rest of Q3 and Q4 of 2021. So I think we talked about this last, maybe around November timeframe. They had just mitigated a pretty large attack at the time. They said it was the largest in history, at least from the ones that have been reported to the world. Because most people, when they get DDoS, they don't like to talk about it, unless you're a cloud provider trying to prevent them. But, you know, they do want to point out that the, you know, things have gotten worse in Q3 and Q4. Not only the levels of them, but the complexity has gotten worse. And they are pointing out that the gaming industry is being hit the hardest with Blizzard, Titanfall, and other games impacted quite heavily. Which I have to say to all you kids out there who are trying to win in all these games by DDoSing the providers, that's really not a good way to win, because you lose long-term as you end up in jail. So I don't recommend this path. But apparently this is something people do to try to win games. And I think only thing I can think of that maybe that's the case is because there's been a lot of esport and gambling on esports. And that's the only reason why this is an attack vector. But, you know, it is kind of interesting. But despite the increase in the gaming, Azure would like to point out all the amazingness they did. And so they have mitigated 1,955 attacks per day on average, which was a 40% increase from the first half of 2021. And the maximum in a single day was 4,296 on August 10th, 2021. I don't know what was going on August 10th. I was going to look it up before the show, but I forgot. And in total, they mitigated 359,713 unique attacks against their global infrastructure, up 43%. And that's just in 6-month window, folks. Man. They also pointed out that, you know, typically the holiday season has always been the DDoS proverbial season, but that is no longer the case. They did not actually see a huge spike in DDoS attacks at the season the holiday season, and that is now a year-round problem, that they're always large and they're always all the time. So do keep that in mind. So like I mentioned back when we last talked about this, there was 2.4 terabytes per second, or terabits per second, as the biggest DDoS attack. But in November, they mitigated 3.47 terabits per second throughput attack and a packet rate of 430 million packets per second targeting a customer of theirs in Asia. They believe this is now the largest attack reported in history. The attack came from 10,000 unique sources and multiple countries. And the attack vector was via UDP reflection on port 80 using a simple service discovery protocol, a connectionless lightweight Active Directory access protocol, and domain name service and NTP comprising one single peak, and the overall attack lasted about 15 minutes. In December, they then mitigated two additional attacks at 2.5 terabits per second, both again in Asia, and they did say that short and burst and multi-vector attacks remain prevalent, but the bursts are now getting much longer. So that's a little bit scary because now they can sustain this load for even longer on your poor, poor website.
Man, I'd love to understand the economics of that.
Again, esport gambling. I don't know. UDP attacks rose the top vector in the second half of 2021, comprising 55% of all attacks, a 16% increase from the first half of 2021, and TCP attacks decreased from 54% to just 19%. Overall, UDP spoof was, of course, the number one with 55%, TCP ACK floods at 14%, and DNS amplification at 6%. And gaming, as I mentioned, continues to be the hardest hit industry of all for DDoS. If you're not considering your DDoS strategy now on any of the Google, Azure, AWS, or GCP provider, you should probably do that right away because it's only a matter of time before you're unfortunately caught in one of these botnets in a bad way.
Yeah, the numbers continue to just astound me and how much there is. That's crazy.
That's what I mean. I mean, that seems like, I mean, I don't know, maybe esport gambling is large enough to fund these types of efforts, but.
Well, I mean, nation state.
I bet there's a lot of commercial, a lot of commercial models we're not thinking of that someone's making money off of with DDoS. Mm-hmm.
Well, you have spying activities because you use DDoS as a distraction while you infiltrate another part of the network because they're too busy looking at something else. That's a definite attack vector. There's trade secrets and just hurting your competitors, in certain ways. Like there's all kinds of things that you could use to justify doing a massive scale DDoS attack. And then some of it's bragging rights. I mean, I'm sure to be the biggest, baddest DDoS attack on this report, I'm sure some bit of bragging rights as well for somebody. So there's all kinds of things that just don't make sense. And there's no cost to these companies because they're just stealing people's computers and making them bots and these big botnets.
Right.
So, the business model is very lucrative because they charge for something they're getting for free, basically.
Hopefully they all go to jail.
Eventually, if they're in the right countries with the right laws and the right police forces. But a lot of times they don't, a lot of times they're nation state sponsored too. And so those people aren't going to jail anytime soon.
Nope.
All right, Peter, take us to the lightning round.
AWS Migration Hub strategy recommendations. Add support for Babelfish for Aurora Postgres.
Oh, good. Babelfish. So I can actually understand some of these migration strategies people have because some of them need a lot of, a lot of complexity and a lot of translation required.
I think this is just going to be another reason why, the recommendations get ignored and everyone just lifts and shifts their giant Microsoft SQL servers into, AWS. Boo.
AWS Client VPN now supports banner text and maximum session duration.
Oh, great.
Hey, Ryan, I attacked your VPN server, but that banner text you had about you're going to send me to the law enforcement, I disconnected. You scared me off.
Yeah. I'm just glad I can enable useless banners for, other people instead of just receiving them. Nice.
Is this written actually in the banner HTML tag?
Ooh, blinky text. Yeah,
I don't. Awesome. It could be. You never know.
Amazon EC2 customers can now use ED25519 keys for authentication with EC2 Instance Connect.
They just used my password for authentication. Like, how am I supposed to use it now?
Right. I was like, when I read this, I was like, I just hope it's, you know, completely seamless that I don't have to think about anything about this. But, you know, I'm still chuckling about ED25519. Sorry, Peter. It's rough.
Beavis and Butthead. He said ED. Amazon FSx for NetApp ONTAP now provides performance and capacity metrics in Amazon CloudWatch.
I mean, of course, were they going to use Google Stackdriver for this?
This is just to enable Amazon to point at NetApp and NetApp to point back at Amazon for all the performance issues that are being observed here. So, sweet.
Wonder if they're also pushing the dollars per second you're spending with your NetApp.
That'd be a good metric.
I did a math project on NetApp CVOs and compute, and the number that came out of that was, I about fell out of my chair. I'm like, I'm paying how much in licensing and how much in compute for this? It was impressive.
More on Amazon FSx for NetApp ONTAP. It now enables you to grow your SSD storage capacity.
So to make Justin fall out of his chair, I'm going to continue to grow these SSDs so that number keeps getting bigger.
Bigger.
I mean, but you can't go above ED25519 in that growth. So, sorry.
Now generally available, Kibana dashboards and visualizations on top of Azure Data Explorer.
I mean, anything's better than the Azure console, so I'll take a Kibana dashboard any day.
I'm still mad at the other Elasticsearch announcement, so just bitter now.
Bitter. AWS Panorama appliances now available for purchase on Amazon.com and Amazon Business.
I was super excited about this. I hit the Amazon.com link in the article. I went to go add to my cart, and then I saw it was $4,000, and I said, that's a nope. And walked right back out.
I was going to do that after this episode, but now, yeah, no way. I don't want to spy on my family that badly.
Right.
Amazon Chime SDK now supports video background replacement.
So this is the, out of all the usability stuff that they're trying to catch up with, this is what they prioritized? Cool. Thanks, Amazon.
Yeah.
I mean, I was always disappointed that I couldn't be on my sales call rep with my Amazon person from France, but now I can be with my video background replaced with my the Eiffel Tower. It'd be lovely. Wee wee! I will pay more for our eyes. Thank you.
Amazon S3 File Gateway adds schedule-based network bandwidth throttling.
Just one more thing that's going to screw me in the middle of the night trying to troubleshoot why something isn't working. Mm-hmm. Thank you for this.
Yep.
Really appreciate it.
What could possibly go wrong? This, you know, large transfers to storage transfers scheduled in the middle of the night, one unattended, no problem.
If someone does the math wrong and puts like 100 kilobits instead of, you know, 100 gigabits, yeah. You know, because they did the math wrong on the 1024 conversion. Yeah, it's great. I can't wait.
To be fair, if they did it during the daytime, it was still going to take down your network. So I guess it's better.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, to be fair, I probably complained that this feature didn't exist.
Yeah, me too, actually. So,
until it exists, then I complain that it exists. Yeah. And let's wrap it up with our favorite topic, Amazon Document DB with MongoDB compatibility now offers a free trial.
So people are spending enough money on Document DB now that just using Document DB instead of MongoDB isn't basically free? Weird.
I was saying that it was so good that they had to give it away for free, but
yeah.
I mean, like when you compare the MongoDB licensing cost versus your Amazon cost to run it, it's very clear which one's cheaper.
And that wraps up our lightning round. I got to go my brain banner, sucks.
Banner text, Babelfish.
We're going ED.
Okay, perfect. Yeah. Perfect.
But my vocabulary is down to like 12 words at this point.
It's it's, you know, slowly the pandemic's eating away at us all.
It doesn't matter what it was for. Just who really got the point at this point? Like, it doesn't matter what we said. We can rerun the tape later.
Congratulations, Justin.
He's hesitant about that. He's not sure it was me.
It was definitely you.
And we start the round 1-1.
1-1, tied up. Yeah, nice. Well, I did do my homework after 2 weeks of not doing it, and I do have things coming up. I've not received any user submissions, but I would, you know, if you want me to promote your event for free, just send that to me via DM on Twitter or hit me up on our Slack room. I will gladly pimp your conference for at least 2 weeks. Let me be fair. If you tell me today and your conference is tomorrow, I won't be able to help you. But if you're at least 2 weeks in advance, I can definitely promote your conference. And so, you know, a couple of things I learned in my research of the events is that Microsoft has not scheduled Ignite or Build yet, which I thought was sort of strange. But, you know, they're probably waiting that out. But they have scheduled an Azure Open Source Day on February 15th, which is completely virtual. And then they also have the SQL Server and Azure SQL Conference April 5th through 7th. And those are the two things that are closest to coming up, both Microsoft, which is nice. And then IBM Think, if you're into the IBM ecosystem of Red Hat and all those things, that's in May 9th through 13th. And then KubeCon EU is going to be May 16th through the 20th. And then RSA Conference is June 6th through the 9th. And that's probably as far out as we need to go at this point. But, you know, so there are some things on the books. Keep an eye on them. I'll keep this updating this as we go. You know, Black Hat's already in the books. VMworld's on the books. But, you know, they're all out in August and Q3, Q4. We'll save those for another day. But, yeah, stuff's coming up. So if you want to go to a conference to get Omicron, that's available to you potentially sometime in the next 6 months. So you're welcome.
Why not?
Well, that is it. Another fantastic week here in the cloud. And I am tired. I'm going to go to bed. Yeah,
it's been a long week already. I don't know what happens.
It has.
I might drink beer.
Well, that's a given.
I didn't say that was.
Of course, I'm going to drink.
That's how I go to sleep. All right, guys. Well, have a great week. Cool. Hopefully, we get Jonathan back next week, and we'll be happy for some once again. But for now, have a great week. See you next week.
Good night. Bye, everybody.
And that is the Week in the Cloud. We'd like to thank our sponsors, Foghorn Consulting and Jump Cloud. Check out our website, the home of the Cloud Pod, where you can join our newsletter, Slack team, and send feedback or ask questions at thecloudpod.net or tweet us with the hashtag #thecloudpod.